From TNN headquarters, this is The Jungle Cast. Hello and welcome to The Jungle Cast. Now we lead off today with Burundi. Now Burundi, country in Africa, has recently had, or today, held elections. However, those elections have been called into question. So, current president, Pierre Nkurunziza, you'll be hearing that name a few times, so I want to make sure I get it right. He was re-elected to a third term, according to the provisional results from the government. Official results will be coming out later, but provisional results haven't coming out. Now, he has won with roughly 70% of the vote. However, there's more to the story. However, especially since the election itself has been called into question, government decided to go through with it, but there's, again, more to it. Now, the opposition, has been boycotting the election. And just in saying the results, despite boycotting the election, opposition leader Agathon Rwasa garnered 19% of the vote. He boycotted, but they left his name on the ballot. So we just want to point out that he did get a pretty significant percentage of the votes. Put that out. So let's actually get into this election. So it's been criticized, as we said, by opposition groups and by outside forces, such as the United States State Department, the African Union, the European Union. It's been criticized by pretty much everyone outside of the government and its supporters. So there are numerous factors at play here. So first of all, Nkurunziza announced he would run for a third term, which you would expect since he was elected to a third term. He announced that would run for a third term. However, there's a constitutional limit of two terms. So you might be saying, okay, now we have possibly a rogue leader who is going out and running for election despite the Constitution. However, the Constitutional Court, the court in Burundi, ruled that he was allowed to run for the third term because his first term did not count. maybe saying, why on earth wouldn't his first term count? Well, for his first term, he was not actually elected by the people. He was not elected democratically. Instead, he was elected by members of parliament. And that has been his reasoning about why he should be allowed to run for a third term. And the Constitutional Court agreed. So, at least in Burundi, Nkurunziza was in the clear here to run for a third term. Court found it legal. He thought it was legal. Or so he thought, well, I should switch that. He thought it was legal. The court backed him up and said it was legal. However, people are still not really liking that, because he hasn't been the most popular leader. Some have compared him to a dictator. But let's just go back into this history about, because, like I said, he was elected by the members of parliament, not democratically. So that starts to get interesting. So we go into history there. So, as I said, he was elected by members of the parliament. So before he was president, Nkurunziza led a Hutu rebel group and fought against the Tutsi-dominated army. Now, here we actually go into history that also impacts other nations of Africa, but a common thread is the Hutus and the Tutsis. The Hutus and the Tutsis are two ethnic groups, for lack of a better word, that really aren't ethnic in the sense. What happened was, before, Africa was colonized by all different countries, large or mostly European countries. Now, one of the most common, or one that had a lot of territory in Africa, was Belgium. And when Belgium started to give these countries independence, they didn't leave everything nice and peaceful. No, they kind of went out with a bang. And that bang caused several more bangs in the form of gunshots. But what the Belgians did was they created two kind of groups. And when we say created, we really mean created, because the Hutus and the Tutsis didn't used to exist until the Belgians said now they would be two different groups. But what they did was they said the Tutsis were the more white-like of the people. So this is why we call them ethnic or race groups. The Tutsis were the more white-like of the groups, and typically the more prominent. The Hutus were the ones that weren't as white. And if you research online, you can actually see different charts and pictures of people getting checked to see whether or not they'd be a Hutus and a Tutsis, or a Tutsi. It's kind of like retroactively applying a race to a whole group of people. So now we've got the Hutus and the Tutsis, two made-up races or ethnic groups. And the Belgians took an extra step. What they did was, the majority of people were Hutus. So very few people were the Tutsis. But the Tutsis were the more prominent, the more white-like. But the key word there is prominent. And so what the Belgians did was, despite the Tutsis being a minority, they put them all in power. So then what you had was, you had a majority of people with very little power. And I don't think I need to actually say what happened. You can guess what happened there. Civil wars and infighting. Because of the Belgians basically turning a group of people against each other. And thinking that there were two separate groups of people. So we see that in other groups or other countries around Africa. The Hutus and the Tutsis. But here in Burundi was another example. Oh, I should say Rwanda was the most prominent example of the Hutus and Tutsis coming in. Because there you had genocidal slaughters of Tutsis and Hutus coming in. But here in Burundi, what you had was the Tutsis, as we said, the more prominent of the group, or the more prominent. They dominated the army. Now, Nkurunziza, led a Hutu rebel group. And he fought against the Tutsi-dominated army. As we said, the Hutus and the Tutsis led to civil wars and infighting. So here you saw Nkurunziza leading a Hutu rebel group that fought against the Tutsi-dominated army. Now, in Burundi, Hutus make up 85% of the population. Just to give you a sense of how disproportionate it was, especially in like a power kind of distribution. 85% of the population, very little power, mostly concentrated in that 15% of the power, or 15% of the population. But again, you had the Nkurunziza with the Hutu rebel group fighting against the Tutsi-dominated army. That's a civil war and infighting. So what the government decided to do was in 2005, they wanted to have a peace deal. That seems logical. But the peace deal said that Nkurunziza, as the Hutu rebel group, and the leader of a rebel group that made up the majority of the population, as part of the peace deal, he became president. So that is why, for his first term, he was elected president by members of parliament, not democratically. Which then, years later, or about 10 years later, had the ramifications of allowing him to run for a third term. The election has been called into question ever since he announced that he would run for a third term back in May. And it's been causing quite a bit of problems. But again, let's go back, take it one step in time, and talk about how the election has been criticized. So U.S. State Department has been pretty big on this. They've been releasing several statements. They actually released another one here on Friday about the election. But let's just say this one a few weeks ago, where they said that the elections lacked legitimacy. Excuse me. But here, let's just read the statement. And this is a quote. The legitimacy of the electoral process in Burundi over the past few months has been tainted by the government's harassment of opposition and civil society members, closing down of media outlets and political space, and intimidation of voters. Dozens have been killed, and as many as 167,000 Burundians are now refugees in neighboring nations, end quote. So there's quite a bit there that they allege of the government, because first of all, you've got harassment of opposition and civil society members, closing down of media outlets, and intimidation of voters. The intimidation of voters is also key. So there have been dozens killed, as the statement said, and estimates put it at least 70 people have been killed since he announced his third term. And there have been violent protests across the country. However, the president accuses the opposition of being behind those violent protests. But violent protests nonetheless. Now, with the voter turnout, we should say It was higher than expected. It was over 70%. However, in the Capitol, it was not that big. Capitol, oddly enough, maybe even ironically, is not filled with all that many supporters of the president. How do we know that? Because in May, after he announced his third run, a coup was attempted by military leaders when Nkurunziza was in Tanzania for talks. Now, the coup was actually initially successful, with the state media being taken over, and Nkurunziza was unable to return. He tried to come back in by flying in, but he couldn't land at the airport. Rebel forces had seized the airport. They wouldn't let him land. So he really had, at least from that avenue, no way of getting back into the country. So initially, this coup was actually successful. However, here you actually see the importance of media, especially in countries where they have one media outlet, typically the state-run media outlet. You actually notice, looking contemporarily and historically, or at least more modern historically, a lot of coups have, or a common thread through coups is taking over the state-run media, because that is one of the easiest ways of getting your message to the people. And especially if it's state-run, that's how the government would get any kind of propaganda out to the citizens. And so rebel groups would take that over and say, A, here's our new propaganda, and we're going to subject you. This is why we're taking over the government. This is why the other guy was evil. And then B, it says, hey, we're actually here. We're in charge. You can see us. But continuing on, initially was successful. The state media was taken over. The military leader went on the radio and television and said, coup has been occurred. Nkurunziza is no longer president. And after he did that, there were pretty supportive outpourings of support in the streets of the capital city. So we can see that he was not as popular in the capital city. But back to the coup. The coup eventually crumbled after pro-Nkurunziza forces took over the state broadcaster. After they held it, this was almost like the ground zero of the coup fight. It was the most important battle, for lack of a better word. After they took over the state media again, or the building, the rebel forces tried to take it over again, take it back from the pro-Nkurunziza forces. However, they failed to do so. After that, the tide pretty much turned against the coup forces, and the leaders surrendered. And the leaders originally all said that this was because they were unhappy that he was running for a third term. But again, a coup having occurred in May, but this, all because of this president announcing a third run, you had a coup occur, you had violent protests, at least 70 killed, hundreds of thousands tens of thousands according to the U.S. State Department, now becoming refugees. And important to note, just finally, when it comes to the legitimacy of the election, the African Union did not send any observers to the election. And that's the first time they've ever done that with a member state. Now, you may be thinking, who cares about sending observers? But that move has been treated as kind of like a treated as going against the elections and saying something against that. Especially if you're listening in the United States, you may be thinking, what's the big deal? People in the United States are not used to having observers there because our elections are free and fair, and typically we don't really have to worry about them, or we don't have a heavy observer presence as is there would be around the world. But here they didn't send observers, and that was portrayed as a sign of them not seeing not respecting the results of the election. So now in the future we'll have to see, especially after the official results come out, the ramifications of this election, how international groups treat this, especially the military treats this, especially knowing that they had already occurred a coup, or attempted a coup, and also the African Union, which had kind of come out against the election. So a lot to look forward in this. The story is not finishing, or is not finished up. Speaking of stories that have not finished up, we've got two with the media. First up, we've got MSNBC. So if MSNBC, we had some pretty big news come out this week, although if you're listening, it may have been last week, where Mediaite's Joe Concha, we want to make sure we actually credit him, because, well, there's more to that story. But he reported on Thursday morning, a little after midnight, that Chuck Todd would be returning to MSNBC for a new daily politics show. Now, the show will be similar, according to Concha, this is all according to Concha, will be similar to his old program, The Daily Rundown, and Todd will continue to anchor Meet the Press on Sunday mornings, which airs on NBC. Now, the setup would be similar to CNN's Jake Tapper, who anchors The Lead on weekdays and hosts CNN's State of the Union on Sunday. Well, actually, both are on CNN. And George Stephanopoulos, who anchors This Week on Sunday and anchors, or co-anchors, Good Morning America on weekdays. Now, speaking of Jake Tapper, his program airs at 4, but according to Concha, the program, or the new program from Chuck Todd, will be airing at 5 o'clock, which is an hour after The Lead. But at 5 o'clock, its cable news counterparts, or rivals, will be The 5 and The Situation Room, which are both pretty politically focused programs in cable news. The 5 being a roundtable program on Fox News with 4 conservatives and 1 liberal talking about the issues of the day. It's very popular in the ratings, although the ratings have been down a little bit ever since Bob Beckel left. And The Situation Room, one of CNN's flagship programs with anchor Wolf Blitzer, focuses a lot on politics and also a heavy emphasis on international news, although that program is also 2 hours, airing at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock. However, The Daily Rundown itself actually does continue to air, but it's now anchored by Jose Diaz-Balart. And since Todd's departure, the show has expanded to 2 hours and also relocated from Washington, D.C. to Miami. In doing so, it's lost a little bit of its politics focus, because when it first came out, it was seen as like an insidery kind of politics show, talking about the top issues that are focusing on political insiders. It was almost compared to like a Politico on television. However, it's lost a little bit of that as it's now in Miami. And obviously when you have a show in Miami, just by very nature of the anchor not being in D.C. and some of the staff not being in D.C., it loses a little bit of that politics focus. Now, what's currently in the time slot, because all the time slots are really filled right now, at 5 o'clock, is The Ed Show. Now, The Ed Show has been moved around quite a bit, actually, recently. What happened was, 2 years ago, it used to be at 8 o'clock p.m., which is prime time, and that's opposite Bill O'Reilly, who is the number one, although at the time was number one. Today he's either number one or a very close second behind Megyn Kelly. By the time, number one by far show in cable news, all of cable news, but he's at 8 o'clock, and The Ed Show was at 8 o'clock as well, and doing fairly well for itself. However, Phil Griffin, who is the head of MSNBC, had a plan for the network. The plan was to double down on wonks, young, politically savvy, and policy knowledgeable reporters and anchors, who knew what they were talking about when it came to policy and could really make arguments based upon that and not just throw bombs around and make loud political arguments. The Ed Show with Ed Schultz also has a radio program, was big on that kind of bomb throwing and calling Republicans names and attacking them, whereas other programs such as Rachel Maddow, it takes a more methodical approach and kind of walks through the different issues in the news stories and then delivers an argument based more upon those kind of facts and statistics and charts. You also saw that that's the same kind of thing that like the Wonk blog does, or Vox. Vox, and actually the Wonk blog, both being started by Ezra Klein, who was floated for a while to replace Ed at 8 o'clock. But the Ed Show moved off to the weekends 2 years ago because Phil Griffin was trying to do kind of kill two birds with one stone. He was trying to get to expand weekend programming, because weekend programming on MSNBC is largely dominated by lockup and caught on camera, or I should just say reality programming that's taped and runs a lot and gets a lot of, got pretty good ratings. But he was trying to expand it to more of the liberal program as they were doubling down on the whole lean forward. At the same time, he was trying to expand MSNBC's weekday lineup with the kind of wonks like Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow, who is the most popular anchor or the most popular program on MSNBC, that seemed like a rational decision. So at 8 o'clock, who he moved there was Chris Hayes. Now Chris Hayes, he hosted a show on Saturday and Sunday mornings called Up. And that show was critically acclaimed and was really beloved for the way it did long pieces, had nuanced arguments, and it was kind of in a field of its own with the way it handled different issues. So they brought him to weekdays, and he had a new show called All In with Chris Hayes, and it started at 8 o'clock. Problem was, the ratings stunk for the program. They were much smaller than Ed Schultz's ratings, and many people kind of contribute that to the fact that what works on Saturday and Sunday mornings doesn't work as well for prime time, because in prime time, we actually did talk about this on our first episode, if you want to look at that, one of the keys is competition and having some kind of buddy in the heads, because with that kind of competition or rivalry or someone disagreeing with each other, that leads to more ratings. Chris Hayes isn't big on disagreements. He's more on trying to just talk and figure out why there are certain issues and looking at how certain problems erupt or started and doing longer reports on those. He kind of took his morning program and then brought it to the prime time, and it didn't really work. They're two different monsters. So now, or ever since then, he's still at the prime at 8 o'clock. Chris Hayes remains at 8 o'clock. But then back over on weekends, Ed Schultz was off on the weekends. Ratings were not as high, and MSNBC started to have ratings problems. So what Griffin did was he took Chris Matthews, and Chris Matthews has been around ever since the channel started. He's actually been around arguably before the channel started, when they had America's Talking, which, fun fact, was run by Roger Ailes, who would later go on to be in charge of, and continue to be in charge of, Fox News. But Chris Matthews, his program was airing at 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock. So he was airing one program and then repeating the exact same program 2 hours later. So what Griffin did was he got rid of, or he kept Matthews on at 7, but got rid of his initial program at 5 and brought back Schultz there. So ever since then, it's been Schultz at 5, and at 6 is Paul Sixnason with Alice Sharpton, which that also has not been a huge rating success. It's been doing all right. And then at 7 is Chris Matthews, 8 o'clock Chris Hayes, 9 o'clock Rachel Maddow. So what we see there, so now Contra is reporting that Schultz is, or at least at 5 o'clock, is done. We don't know where Schultz is going right away, and Schultz isn't really the personality that would take a firing so lightly or so quietly. So it's possible that he may be moved off to weekends again, or at least there for a while until eventually he goes away. But at 5 o'clock, he'd be gone. And according to Contra, what's also heading towards cancellation is The Cycle at 3 o'clock, and now with Alex Wagner, which airs at 4 o'clock. So basically, 3 straight hours of MSNBC programming is going to be gone. The only one that we really know what it's going to be replaced by is Chuck Todd at 5 o'clock. Now, before I brought up Politico, we brought up Joe Contra and why it's important to mention him, so I'll just address that before we get on too far. What happened was, Contra reported this and put it up at shortly after midnight, and then around 7 or 8, Playbook, Politico's Playbook, which is ran by Mike Allen, reported with the exclusive that Chuck Todd was returning to MSNBC for a Politico program. So, we just wanted to make sure that Contra got his due credit. Yes? So back to 3 and 4. Contra says he doesn't know what's going to be there at the time, or nothing specific, but we do know that it's going to be a standard newscast. It's not going to be a liberal programming or a liberal opinion or a panel show like the Now or arguably the Cycle, but it's going to be a standard straight newscast. And what this reflects is under new NBC News Group chairman Andy Lack trying to bring back together NBC News and MSNBC. Under the past few years, MSNBC and NBC News have drifted apart because as MSNBC has become more and more liberal, NBC News personalities have been hesitant to kind of mix with them for fear that they would be then accused of liberal bias. And of course, especially with the three main newscasts, they try to maintain objectivity and try to present themselves as objective and fair to both sides, not having any kind of bias, because they are talking to the entire nation, which is Democrats and Republicans and independents and third parties. But under Andy Lack, the plan is, and this is largely because the liberal programming, as championed by Phil Griffin, has failed, especially with no kind of opponent to rail against. It worked well in the 2012 campaign because they could go against Mitt Romney, who is the Republican candidate, but Comcast and NBC Universal are looking for a strategy that works more than just every 4 years. But under Andy Lack, he's trying to bring back together MSNBC and NBC News and kind of bring MSNBC back closer to the mothership. Now, Andy Lack would be familiar with MSNBC being close to NBC News because he was the president of NBC News when MSNBC was started. MSNBC was started, the reason it's called MSNBC, MS stands for Microsoft, is because in the 90s, Microsoft and NBC came together and tried to create almost like an interactive news pro or news channel. And then what happened with that was it wasn't very successful, but at the same time, it served as an outlet to feature NBC News personalities on a show other than just Today or NBC Nightly News. It's where Brian Williams had a show for several years as they groomed him and tried to get him ready for Nightly News. And eventually he went to NBC to Nightly News and no longer had a show on MSNBC, which actually the news on his program was called The News with Brian Williams. And it was pretty much just like Nightly News, and it was designed for people who had missed Nightly News. And of course, I could get into how missing the evening newscast led to the founding of CNN, but we can bring that up in a whole different podcast. The News with Brian Williams was on MSNBC for several years and eventually moved on to CNBC to much lower ratings, but by that time, Williams was already kind of starting to measure up the curtains, dare we say, for his position on Nightly News. But speaking of Brian Williams is also coming back to MSNBC because he's currently been suspended, he's currently suspended for lying about news stories that he'd covered, but the suspension ends next month, and as they announced several weeks ago, Lester Holt would take over NBC Nightly News, and Brian Williams would go to MSNBC as their breaking news and special events anchor. So, what's a possibility is that Brian Williams may get a newscast. However, during an employee meeting, this is according to Jordan Cheriton of The Wrap, Lack ruled out any kind of newscast for Williams, but it's still a possibility. So, there's always the possibility that it may happen. But according to Cheriton of The Wrap, or Jordan Cheriton of The Wrap, Lack had ruled it out at the employee meeting. So that, of course, leaves 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock empty. If Williams had gone on at 3 o'clock, that would have pitted him against CNN's Brooke Baldwin, who has had several rating success recently and has actually won the month several times, and Shepard Smith. And then you'd have Shepard Smith, who is the breaking news anchor for Fox News, going against Brian Williams, the breaking news anchor for MSNBC. But according to Sheridan, or according to Lack, we should say, that's ruled out for now. So, what's also interesting when we bring up the staff meeting, Lack did float the idea of a name change, according to the New York Daily News. However, that did not go over very well, and so it was temporarily shelved. But Lack, according to Brian Stelter of CNN, is still kind of thinking about it. So, we'll just leave that there. Now, there's been quite a few programming changes that have come to MSNBC lately, as Phil Griffin looks to jolt the ratings back up. As we said, the network had rating success in 2012 with the election, but ever since then, the ratings have sagged. Because, and you can look at our podcast, our first podcast, for more on the troubles facing MSNBC and why they have declining ratings. But, and of course, how that lead, and what we really talked about was how there was no kind of disagreements and how that led to lower ratings. But the network has had declining ratings ever since the 2012 election, and especially with President Obama, not the excitement over him is over, as we are actively, the nation is actively looking at a replacement. Not, I shouldn't say replacement, that is a poor choice of words, is starting to look at his successor, as we do every 4 and 8 years. But the nation is starting to move on from President Obama, and so there's not a big ratings draw, there's nothing really big bringing in viewers for MSNBC. Now you may be saying, well, cable news gets big ratings for breaking news. Well, that is true. Fox News and CNN get really good ratings for breaking news. CNN especially gets a good improvement from breaking news. But you notice I said Fox News and CNN. I didn't say MSNBC. MSNBC, when breaking news occurs, doesn't really get that much of a jump because viewers have associated it with liberal programming and very little news instead of an analysis. If you hear there's a gun shooting, for example, or a shooting, you go to CNN to hear about it. But then for MSNBC, you then go to that to hear them talk about why we need more gun control. That's how it would play for a viewer. CNN's where you hear about the shooting, and then MSNBC is where you talk about the shooting. But, so then with losing out on breaking news, that's kind of been a double whammy and really hurt MSNBC. And Phil Griffin once said MSNBC was, quote, not the place, end quote, for breaking news. Now, he was criticized and blasted for that remark, but it did reflect the reality for MSNBC in both ratings and programming choices. Like we said, ratings-wise, they didn't get a jump, and programming-wise, they didn't focus all that much on breaking news. Instead, they focused on analysis of the news, typically through a liberal lens. However, MSNBC plans on doubling down on breaking news now. They've got Brian Williams as a breaking news anchor. And when I mentioned the programming changes, both Ronan Farrow and Joyanne Reed had their programs canceled earlier this year. And those low-rated opinion broadcasts were replaced by MSNBC Live with Thomas Roberts. And it's more traditional in the sense of being a straight newscast and focusing on breaking news, although it hasn't been that much of a rating success either. But now the network plans on focusing on breaking news again and really bringing in NBC news personalities to bring your brains. Right now, they've got Tamron Hall and Andrea Mitchell, who have broadcasts at 11 a.m. and noon. And those are pretty much the two prominent NBC news personalities who have shows on MSNBC. Certainly a drastic change from the early days of MSNBC, where that's where it was almost like the AAA equivalent in baseball, where you've got the Yankees and their top players, and then they've got their farm system. And at the Rail Riders, which are in Scranton Wilkes-Barre, you've got the players that eventually will become Yankees. You have them play there and they get good and eventually you call them up. That was the whole purpose of MSNBC, in a way. You had Brian Williams there on the little AAA team practicing, and then after Tom Brokaw retired, you called him up, and he anchored NBC Nightly News for a decade. So now, it's basically a return to roots for MSNBC, going back to a partnership or closer alliance with NBC News, focusing on breaking news. However, we'll have to see what kind of happens, because MSNBC, when it first started off, was not a rating success. That's why it eventually shifted away, was because it wasn't working in the ratings. Because viewers, why would they go to MSNBC for breaking news if they'd already gotten used to going to CNN? And of course, viewer patterns can be a pretty difficult thing to break. That's a challenge for any new network, is to make viewers say, or is to make viewers give it a shot, and then make that part of their daily habits. And viewers have had a habit for the last 35 years of turning to CNN in some shape or other, whether it be television or now going online, for breaking news coverage. So MSNBC is going to have to try to peel them away. And like I said, the whole breaking news did not work for MSNBC. That's why eventually they went from trying to out CNN to trying to out Fox. They had Michael Savage on, and they had a lot of right-wing hosts on. But that wasn't really working because conservatives were going to Fox News. And so they brought in Keith Olbermann, and that's where they really started to have rating success, was with Keith Olbermann and his criticism of the Bush administration, because he had the butt in the head, the competition, and someone that Olbermann couldn't compete against. And at the time, a liberal going against the Republican administration wasn't that common on television. You had a network, CNN, that just gave you the news. You had a network where Republicans railed against Democrats, but liberals didn't have a place. So when Olbermann presented that, it was a rating success because it was new and there was nothing kind of against it. But now there's A, a saturation, and B, no one for them to rail against. So the viewers aren't turning in. So we'll have to continue to see there. It seems more changes are coming. The show, according to Chancha, is coming in September for Chuck Todd. We don't know what the name will be. Possibly they would keep the name The Daily Rundown, but then the current Daily Rundown with Jose Diaz-Balart would have to get a new name. So we'll have to see what the name is. And of course, figure out what airs at 3 and 4 o'clock and who will be there. Now, coming up, we got some more kind of election new or press news with Donald Trump and the press relations. So Donald Trump has been in the news quite a bit. Well, he's been in the news a lot recently, but his press relations have been kind of all over the place. So what happened was he went to the border this week, he toured it, and he held a press conference. And Jose Diaz-Balart, as we just brought up, he actually played a role in that as well. What happened with that was, at the press conference that Donald Trump held, Jose Diaz-Balart asked a question to Donald Trump. Now, Jose Diaz-Balart is part of, in addition to being an anchor on MSNBC, he's also part of Telemundo, which is owned by NBC Universal, as is MSNBC. He tried to ask a question, and then Trump railed against him, said he was taking his remarks, Ballard was taking Trump's comments out of context and twisting them around. He turned it into a rant against the media, and eventually Jose Diaz-Balart did not even get his question answered, because as he tried to finish it, Trump cut him off and said, "No, you're not going to get to ask a question." And of course, the interesting thing there is Trump has kind of come against Univision where Univision used to broadcast Miss Universe and Miss USA, but they announced that they would not do so, and Trump is currently suing them for that. And of course, with Telemundo, that is owned by NBC, which Trump is also not very happy with, because they've cut ties with him They used to have ties with him. He used to have a show on NBC. So he's not very happy with NBC either. So he's not really doing so well with the Spanish networks. But now we have the Donald Trump campaign taping these things up to an extra step where with the Des Moines Register. And the Des Moines Register last week, or 2 weeks ago, depending on when you're listening to this, had called on Donald Trump to quit the Republican race. They said he would become a distraction and his candidacy was basically a joke, but they called on him to drop out. So what happened was Trump blasted them for that, as you can imagine, because Trump blasts anyone that disagrees with him. But now it's up to a new stage where Register, or the political columnist for the Register, or all political columnists for the Register, Kathy Obradovich, she tried to go to one of his events, which was a family picnic, and she was turned away, or I shouldn't say turned away because it hasn't occurred yet, but she wasn't allowed to get a press pass or a press credential. What happens is, take kind of behind the scenes, whenever there are events like these, campaigns give out tickets or a certain amount of tickets in order to control the amount of people in there and make sure they have enough space for everyone. But the press have their own kind of tickets, press credentials, which A, get them in through a different kind of entrance typically, and B, allows them into a place where they can put their cameras or microphones or whatever and have their own kind of space set up. And also, there's typically outlets so they can type on the laptops and all the other fun stuff. But Kathy Obradovich was refused a press credential. So the campaign manager for Trump, Corey Lewandowski, told her that the Register was being excluded because of the editorial. Now, first of all, we should just mention how the editorial board is different than the editorial side. And I'm purposely using those same words because I know that sounds confusing. But there is the editorial side, which is reporters and editors. And then there's the editorial board, which is typically executives or high-ranking members of the company. And the editorial board is responsible for like the opinion pieces and kind of stuff like that. But they're different than the edit. They're inside the... If you were to look at it as a business versus editorial, they'd fit in on the editorial side, but they're separate. I know it sounds confusing, but just with they use the same word several times, and this is just a little odd linguistically. There's editorial in the sense of an op-ed, and there's also editorial as in the sense of the news gathering side. But the campaign manager told her that, and this is the quote, "We're not issuing credentials to anyone from the Des Moines Register based on the editorial that they wrote early in the week," end quote. So that means that the Trump campaign now has a policy of excluding the Des Moines Register reporters based off something that they had no control over. Now, to their credit, the Trump campaign did say that they would consider allowing the Register to attend events at some point, or eventually changing the policy. But for now, they have a policy of not allowing any reporters to any events. So, to put that in historical perspective, I know this word gets thrown out a lot, but that's truly Nixon-esque. So if we can play, or open up the history books for a moment, we'll go back to Watergate. Now, Nixon, as we all kind of know, was a fairly paranoid and secretive person and really liked to... We all know the history of the enemies list that he kept and had kept for most of his lifetime. That should tell you a good deal about Richard Nixon. But what happened was when Watergate occurred, there were the two main reporters, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, who really took the lead and were the main two people investigating Watergate and eventually all the whole other apparatus of the Nixon campaign, known as the Committee to Re-elect the President, which has since taken on the acronym of CREEP. At the time, it was just CRP, but now people make it into creep, which does work, because you'd use committee, R or C, to re, R-E, there's the R-E, elect, E, the president, P, creep. But we continue. The Nixon campaign, or the Nixon White House, we used to say, did not like the coverage, as you can imagine, because it made them out to be criminals. And so what they did was they started putting the pressure on the Washington Post. Now, first, they just blasted the Washington Post. They had surrogates, and the press secretary claimed that the Washington Post was doing dishonest reporting. During the election, they said that the Washington Post was in it for McGovern, and that's why they were writing these articles. And afterwards, they started removing or not allowing reporters to cover it. The Washington Post had a reporter who would cover the social events at the White House. And so the Nixon White House, in order to get at her and the whole Washington Post, in order to make them feel the heat, started not inviting her to state dinners. The White House reporter, or the White House correspondent for the Washington Post, found that his sources would not talk to him. And it's a very difficult job for a reporter when your sources won't talk to you. So the Nixon White House, due to the actions of the top editor, Ben Bradley, and two reporters, started putting pressure on all the reporters in order to get the paper to stop doing its reporting. And now we're seeing a similar thing here where the Des Moines Register has put out this editorial criticizing Donald Trump, and Trump and his campaign are responding by saying, if you don't like our campaign and you see our campaign as a joke, then you're not going to get to cover this joke. You're not going to get to cover this campaign. So take that. So just the continuing saga in the relations between Donald Trump and the press, which we actually also covered last week. It's interesting how the stories from one podcast end up coming in with another podcast. And speaking of events that occurred in another podcast, we've got a continuation of last week's, where we're going to see a kinder, gentler Gawker. So on Monday, Gawker Media will relaunch, symbolically and physically, because on Monday, they'll be moving into new offices. But at the same time, the Gawker Media and Gawker.com will be relaunching. And head Nick Denton, or who's also the founder, says that, and also CEO, says that the site will be, quote, 10 to 15% nicer, end quote. And that is coming from Capital New York. Capital New York have reported that. So this is all a continuation of what happened a week ago, where Gawker did a report on the CFO of Condé Nast and a gay escort that he had hired. And the escort basically tried to blackmail and extort him for his political influence. The CFO's brother was a Secretary of the Treasury in the Obama administration. And so the CFO backed out, paid, but backed out, realizing what the escort was trying to do. And then Gawker reported on that and kind of intentionally helped the escort. But what happened was the story was widely criticized. And for more on this story and the immediate fallout, you can look at last week, but the fallout has continued. So first, on Monday, two of the top editors at Gawker quit. They cited the business side getting involved in a vote being taken in order to remove the post, but they disliked that. So the one was Tom Craigs. The other one, I just want to double check the name before I say it. But they resigned and said that they were not going to be part of this, or they are not going to be part of Gawker anymore. They disliked what had happened. Oh, yes. So it was the Gawker executive editor and the editor-in-chief. They both resigned over the story being deleted. Not the story being written, but but it being deleted, because it was deleted by Nick Denton after the executive committee decided to do so. So the two that resigned were Tommy Craigs, who was the executive editor of Gawker Media, which is the entire network of sites, and there are several sites, and the editor-in-chief of Gawker.com, that one site, Max Reed. They both resigned over the deletion of the story. Now, since then, Nick Denton has really taken the reins at the company and tried to shift it and told its employees that they need to A, be nicer, and B, focus on stories that are true and newsworthy. Because he said, or the key word he's really been using is interesting. Because he said, while the story about the CFO may have been true, it wasn't particularly interesting. So Denton has also said that they need to be kinder. Now, Denton has said that Gawker as a brand is toxic, and has said that there are advertisers who will advertise on other sites, but will not do so on Gawker just because of the name and the reputation. Gawker has the site, we should say, has become known for being really sassy and almost kind of like and sarcastic. And at first, that was one of the kind of admirable traits about the website, was how it was so different. It was almost refreshing in how kind of it, in its disrespect of authority figures, was refreshing and different than the traditional media. However, since then, it's kind of almost gotten worse in a sense where people, jerky, well, there's another word to use, but this is a family-friendly podcast, and we're not going to use it. But the writing style has been criticized as being overly rude and angry, sometimes for seemingly no reason. But the writers are just angry and taking out fury against the target of the blog post, whoever it happens to be. So now Denton is saying you have to be 10 to 15% nicer. And you also have to be interesting. And what's happening is, in addition to all these people resigning, the company is also giving out severance pay as they implement these new editorial policies. Because they say, as we move over to this, if you don't want to be part of this, then you can leave and get severance pay. So Gawker Media, arguably, has been one of the most free journalism websites. And that's been one of the praises of it by the journalists that it hires, is that they were able to write stories that they would rarely get to write on or report on at other news outlets. But Gawker Media is now kind of changing that editorial policy, and in doing so, they're really going after one target. And this is one that Denton has brought up several times, is Vox Media, especially kind of Vox.com. So Denton says that the site will now have explainers. Explainers are something that really took off with Vox.com, where their whole tagline is explain the news. And what happened is, for different news events and news stories, they'd have flashcards, just like you would use in school, where there'd be a question about a news topic saying, or for example, saying, what is it? Who's involved? Why is this occurring? And then you'd flip and there would be the answer and an explanation about who was involved, why it was occurring. So that way you could really get up to speed on a story, even if it had been occurring for several years at that point. So now Denton says that they're going to start doing explainers, but they're going to be juicier, whatever you want to make of that kind of. And of course, this is all coming as the media network, or the whole network, is fighting for its very survival. They were sued by Hulk Hogan recently because they published his sex tape, and Hulk Hogan sued them. And Denton has said that there's roughly a 10% chance that they could lose and bankrupt the company. So, troubling times for Gawker right now, as they're trying to fight for their very survival, both externally and internally. But they are moving over to new offices and be a new day. So we'll have to see come Monday, that'll be the key day, what the relaunch of Gawker looks like, and whether or not Gawker Media relaunches. Because, especially for online advertising, the key is, or especially for online websites and online news organizations, the key is advertising. And if you can't get those advertisers, you have trouble. And Gawker.com has had trouble, both recently and long-term, has had trouble due to the kind of vicious nature of the site attracting advertisers. So Denton, in a focus on both getting those advertisers and also in keeping some kind of respect for the news website, says, be kinder, or you can leave. We'll have to see what happens with that. Well, when we're looking to the future, we can also just kind of look at the end of this. Maybe the future is a good place to wrap this up. I'd like to thank you for joining us on the JungleCast today. We had a great podcast, if I do say so, for looking at the media, international news. As always, send us your comments on Twitter, at TKNNPOLJungle. You can also use the Contact Us form on TKNN if you want to get in touch, tnn.info. Send us your tips, comments, questions, suggestions, anything you want to say, send it to us. We love hearing from you. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes. We're on there. We also on other podcast outlets if you want to check there. If you're an Android user, for example, want to make sure you can get us. So subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe wherever you are. Be sure to always listen to the podcast. And if you can, give us a review online. So that way we get a feel of what we can improve on. Or maybe you just want to share the love. That always helps our podcast. Just when improving it, and also getting the word out. And of course, always be sure to listen, as I said. But regardless, for TKNN, I'm Tyler, wishing you good news and a good night.